Chapter 8. Echoes, sir. His first purchase was an Echo in Georgia that repeated 4 times. His next was a 6-repeater in Maryland. His next was a 13-repeater in Maine. His next was a 9-repeater in Kansas. His next was a 12-repeater in Tennessee, which he got cheap, so to speak, because it was out of repair, a portion of the crag which reflected it having tumbled down. He believed he could repair it at a cost of a few $1,000s, and, by increasing the elevation with masonry, treble the repeating capacity. But the architect who undertook the job had never built an Echo before, and so he utterly spoiled this one. Before he meddled with it, it used to talk back like a mother-in-law, but now it was only fit for the deaf and dumb asylum. Well, next he bought a lot of cheap little double-barreled Echoes, scattered around over various states and territories. He got them at 20% off by taking the lot. Next he bought a perfect Gatling gun of an Echo in Oregon, and it cost a fortune, I can tell you. You may know, sir, that in the Echo market the scale of prices is cumulative, like the carat scale in diamonds. In fact, the same phraseology is used. A single carat Echo is worth, but $10 over and above the value of the land it is on. A 2-carat or double-barreled Echo is worth $30. A 5-carat is worth $950. A 10-carat is worth $13,000. My uncle's Oregon Echo, which he called the Great Pit Echo, was a 22-carat gem, and cost $216,000. They threw the land in, for it was 400 miles from a settlement. Well, in the meantime my path was a path of roses. I was the accepted suitor of the only and lovely daughter of an English earl, and was beloved to distraction. In that dear presence I swam in seas of bliss. The family were content, for it was known that I was sole heir to an uncle held to be worth $5 millions. However, none of us knew that my uncle had become a collector, at least in anything more than a small way, for aesthetic amusement. Now gathered the clouds above my unconscious head. That divine Echo, since known throughout the world as the Great Koh-i-Noor, or Mountain of Repetitions, was discovered. It was a 65-carat gem. You could utter a word, and it would talk back at you for 15 minutes, when the day was otherwise quiet. But behold, another fact came to light at the same time. Another Echo collector was in the field. The two rushed to make the peerless purchase. The property consisted of a couple of small hills with a shallow swale between, out yonder among the back settlements of New York State. Both men arrived on the ground at the same time, and neither knew the other was there. The Echo was not all owned by one man. A person by the name of Williamson Bolivar Jarvis owned the East Hill, and a person by the name of Harbison J. Bledsoe owned the West Hill. The swale between was the dividing line. So while my uncle was buying Jarvis's hill for $3,285,000, the other party was buying Bledsoe's hill for a shade over $3,000,000. Now, do you perceive the natural result? Why, the noblest collection of Echoes on earth was forever and ever incomplete, since it possessed but the one half of the King Echo of the universe. Neither man was content with this divided ownership, yet neither would sell to the other. There were jawings, bickerings, heartburnings. And at last that other collector, with a malignity which only a collector can ever feel toward a man and a brother, proceeded to cut down his hill. You see, as long as he could not have the Echo, he was resolved that nobody should have it. He would remove his hill, and then there would be nothing to reflect my uncle's Echo. My uncle remonstrated with him, but the man said, "I own one end of this Echo. I choose to kill my end. You must take care of your own end yourself." Well, my uncle got an injunction put on him. The other man appealed, and fought it in a higher court. They carried it on up, clear to the Supreme Court of the United States. It made no end of trouble there. Two of the judges believed that an echo was personal property because it was impalpable to sight and touch, and yet was purchasable, saleable, and consequently taxable. Two others believed that an echo was real estate because it was manifestly attached to the land and was not removable from place to place. Other of the judges contended that an echo was not property at all. It was finally decided that the echo was property, that the hills were property, that the two men were separate and independent owners of the two hills, but tenants in common in the echo. Therefore, defendant was at full liberty to cut down his hill, since it belonged solely to him, but must give bonds in $3 million as indemnity for damages which might result to my uncle's half of the echo. This decision also debarred my uncle from using defendant's hill to reflect his part of the echo. Without defendant's consent, he must use only his own hill. If his part of the echo would not go, under these circumstances, it was sad, of course, but the court could find no remedy. The court also debarred defendant from using my uncle's hill to reflect his end of the echo without consent. You see the grand result. Neither man would give consent, and so that astonishing and most noble echo had to cease from its great powers. And since that day, that magnificent property is tied up and unsaleable. A week before my wedding day, while I was still swimming in bliss, and the nobility were gathering from far and near to honor our espousals, came news of my uncle's death, and also a copy of his will, making me his sole heir. He was gone. Alas, my dear benefactor was no more. The thought surcharges my heart even at this remote day. I handed the will to the Earl. I could not read it for the blinding tears. The Earl read it. Then he sternly said, "Sir, do you call this wealth? But doubtless you do in your inflated country. Sir, you are left sole heir to a vast collection of echoes, if a thing can be called a collection, that is scattered far and wide over the huge length and breadth of the American continent. Sir, this is not all. You are head and ears in debt. There is not an echo in the lot, but has a mortgage on it. Sir, I am not a hard man, but I must look to my child's interest. If you had but one echo which you could honestly call your own, if you had but one echo which was free from encumbrance, so that you could retire to it with my child, and by humble, painstaking industry cultivate and improve it, and thus rest from it a maintenance, I would not say you nay. But I cannot marry my child to a beggar. Leave his side, my darling. Go, sir, take your mortgage-ridden echoes, and quit my sight forever." My noble Celestine clung to me in tears, with loving arms, and swore she would willingly, nay gladly, marry me, though I had not an echo in the world. But it could not be. We were torn asunder, she to pine and die within the 12th month, I to toil life's long journey sad and alone, praying daily, hourly, for that release which shall join us together again in that dear realm, where the wicked cease from troubling, and the weary are at rest. Now, sir, if you will be so kind as to look at these maps and plans in my portfolio, I am sure I can sell you an echo for less money than any man in the trade. Now this one, which cost my uncle $10, 30 years ago, and is one of the sweetest things in Texas, I will let you have for, let me interrupt you, I said. Why friend, I have not had a moment's respite from canvassers this day. I have bought a sewing machine which I did not want. I have bought a map which is mistaken in all its details. I have bought a clock which will not go. I have bought a moth poison which the moths prefer to any other beverage. I have bought no end of useless inventions, and now I have had enough of this foolishness. I would not have one of your echoes, if you were even to give it to me. I would not let it stay on the place. I always hate a man that tries to sell me echoes. You see this gun? Now take your collection and move on. Let us not have bloodshed. But he only smiled a sad, sweet smile, and got out some more diagrams. You know the result perfectly well, because you know that, when you have once opened the door to a canvasser, the trouble is done, and you have got to suffer defeat. I compromised with this man at the end of an intolerable hour. I bought two double-barreled Echoes in good condition, and he threw in another, which he said was not saleable because it only spoke German. He said she was a perfect polyglot once, but somehow her palate got down. An encounter with an interviewer, the nervous, dapper, pure young man took the chair I offered him, and said he was connected with the Daily Thunderstorm, and added, "Hoping it's no harm, I've come to interview you."
"Come to what?"
"Interview you."
"Ah, I see. Yes, yes. Yes, yes."
I was not feeling bright that morning. Indeed, my power seemed a bit under a cloud. However, I went to the bookcase, and when I had been looking 6 or 7 minutes, I found I was obliged to refer to the young man. I said, "How do you spell it?"
"Spell what?"
"Interview."
"Oh, my goodness. What do you want to spell it for?"
"I don't want to spell it. I want to see what it means."
"Well, this is astonishing, I must say.
I can tell you what it means, if you,
oh, all right.
That will answer, and much obliged to you too.
Inter,
then you spell it with an H?"
"Why, certainly."
"Oh, that is what took me so long."
"Why, my dear sir, what did you propose to spell it with?"
"Well, I hardly know. I had the unabridged, and I was ciphering around in the back end, hoping I might treat her among the pictures. But it's a very old edition."
"Why, my friend, they wouldn't have a picture of it in even the latest E-dash,
my dear sir, I beg your pardon, I mean no harm in the world, but you do not look as intelligent as I had expected you would."
"No harm, I mean no harm at all."
"Oh, don't mention it. It has often been said, and by people who would not flatter, and who could have no inducement to flatter, that I am quite remarkable in that way."
"Yes, yes. They always speak of it with rapture."
"I can easily imagine it.
But about this interview.
You know it is the custom now to interview any man who has become notorious."
"Indeed, I had not heard of it before.
It must be very interesting.
What do you do it with?"
"Ah, well, this is disheartening. It ought to be done with a club in some cases. But customarily it consists in the interviewer asking questions and the interviewed answering them. It is all the rage now.
Will you let me ask you certain questions calculated to bring out the salient points of your public and private history?"
"Oh, with pleasure, with pleasure. I have a very bad memory, but I hope you will not mind that.
That is to say, it is an irregular memory, singularly irregular.
Sometimes it goes in a gallop, and then again it will be as much as a fortnight passing a given point.
This is a great grief to me."
"Oh, it is no matter, so you will try to do the best you can."
"I will. I will put my whole mind on it."
"Thanks. Are you ready to begin?"
"Ready."
"Q. How old are you?"
"A 19, in June."
"Q indeed. I would have taken you to be 35 or 6.
Where were you born?"
"A. In Missouri."
"Q. When did you begin to write?"
"A. In 1836.
"Q. Why, how could that be, if you are only 19 now?"
"A. I don't know. It does seem curious, somehow."
"Q. It does, indeed.
Whom do you consider the most remarkable man you ever met?"
"A. Aaron Burr."
"Q. But you never could have met Aaron Burr, if you are only 19 years."
"A. Now, if you know more about me than I do, what do you ask me for?"
"Q. Well, it was only a suggestion. Nothing more."
"How did you happen to meet Burr?"
"A. Well, I happened to be at his funeral one day, and he asked me to make less noise, and..."
"Q. But, good heavens! If he were at his funeral, he must have been dead, and if he was dead, how could he care whether you made a noise or not?"
"A. I don't know. He was always a particular kind of a man that way."
"Q. Still, I don't understand it at all. You say he spoke to you, and that he was dead."
"A. I didn't say he was dead."
"Q. But wasn't he dead?"
"A. Well, some said he was, some said he wasn't."
"Q. What did you think?"
"A. Oh, it was none of my business.
It wasn't any of my funeral. Did you, however, we can never get this matter straight. Let me ask about something else. What was the date of your birth?
A. Monday, October 31st, 1693.
Q. What?
Impossible. That would make you 180 years old. How do you account for that?
A. I don't account for it at all.
Q. But you said at first you were only 19, and now you make yourself out to be 180. It is an awful discrepancy.
A. Why, have you noticed that?
Shaking hands.
Many a time it has seemed to me like a discrepancy, but somehow I couldn't make up my mind.
How quick you notice a thing.
Q. Thank you for the compliment, as far as it goes. Had you, or have you, any brothers or sisters?
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.